Walk up this exit ramp. There's a rest stop. There'll be somebody there.
As Decker exited the car, he thought again that all of this had been arranged well before he had contacted them through the website. They had clearly expected him to do this, or at least hoped that he would. And he had, which meant they had read him right. He hoped to have done the same for them. He trudged through the snow to the rest stop with his bag slung over his shoulder. The snowfall had slowed, but his feet were soaked through. His belly was rumbling, and his nose was running. The white panel van was backed into the first parking space. The headlights blinked twice as Decker approached. The driver's window came down. It was another woman, with hollowed-out cheekbones. She looked like a druggie, slipping in and out of withdrawal. "You want me to drive?" said Decker, running his gaze up and down her skinny frame. "I want to get there in one piece." She shook her head and jerked her thumb toward the back of the van. "You sure you're good to go?" In answer, she put the van in drive and stared out the windshield. Decker clambered into the back and slid the side door closed. The woman drove off as Decker settled into the seat. The gun placed against his right temple didn't unduly surprise him. After all, how many people could they engage to get him to this point? He had figured two max, and he'd been right. His bag was taken from him and thrown out the back door. He was searched, and he could tell the searcher was surprised that Decker was not armed. His phone was taken from him and hurled out the back as well. The man tugged on his sleeve and tossed an orange jumper over the seat and into Decker's lap. He held it up. "It looks a little small." Neither of them spoke. "Do you go by Billy now, Belinda?" Decker said to the driver. "Or was that just for the 7-Eleven gig?" He watched as the wig came off. The eyes that flashed at him in the rear view were the same ones he'd seen at the convenience store, but they were very different from the eyes that he had remembered seeing at the Institute, the pair that had belonged to the devastated teenage girl named Belinda Wyatt. She apparently was gone for good. He said, "The disguise was good, but I have your hands memorized. Hard to change them unless you wear gloves." She just kept staring at him, and in those eyes, Decker could see the cumulative hatred of 20 years that was about to be unleashed on me. Decker held up the jumper. "A little privacy, please." The eyes looked away. He started undressing, which was difficult in the confined space for someone so large. The person with the gun took his clothes and shoes and threw them out the back. Decker struggled into the jumper, but could not zip it up in front because of his large gut. He slumped back in the seat and turned to the man holding the gun and squatting in the back of the van. "Hello, Sebastian." He eyed the gun. It was an S&W 45 caliber, the 45. The weapon used to kill his wife and half the people at Mansfield. This gun had been the last thing his wife had seen before her life ended. Maybe it had been used to kill Giles Evers, too. He didn't know for sure. Maybe a quick bullet wasn't in the cards for the cop-turned-rapist. But then again, he didn't give a damn about Giles Evers. Leopold pressed the barrel tighter against Decker's cheekbone. "I didn't know your situation, Belinda," said Decker. "When I stood up in the group session and said I wanted to go into law enforcement, that I wanted to be a cop, I didn't know that a bad cop had lured you into a gang rape and almost killed you." The eyes flashed once more at him, but the driver said nothing. Decker's mind whirred back to that day at the Institute. His 20 years younger self stood in the middle of the group and proclaimed that his ambition now was to go into law enforcement to be a good cop. That he wanted to protect others, keep them from harm. He had looked around at all the people, folks like him, with new and sometimes scary minds and personalities. His words had been met with admiring smiles by some and indifference by others, but one pair of eyes had been staring at him with something more than all the others combined. He could see that clearly now. Apparently his perfect mind had flaws, because this memory, while all was there, had not made an impression on him. He had glossed right over it until he hadn't glossed right over it. It had struck him while he had been rubbing his old badge through the plastic back at the Burlington police station. My genie. My wish come true. Death. Plastic badge, he thought, right before the epiphany had struck him. A plastic cop, not a real cop. A cop who hurt you. Giles Evers. And from my words, you lumped me right in with him. And maybe I can understand that, because right at that moment you probably were the most vulnerable you would ever be. He recalled those eyes as the deepest, most shocked pair he had ever seen, but he hadn't registered it, because he had been very nervous standing up in front of strangers to talk about his future. His mind stopped worrying, and he returned to the present. He said to Wyatt, "That's why you singled me out, right? Bro. Brotherhood of cops, brotherhood of football players, because I was one of them too. Everyone at the Institute knew about that. But not your bro, their bro. Giles Evers and his bunch. But I came here to tell you that I didn't know what had happened to you. If I had, I wouldn't have said what I did. I'm sorry. I wanted to be a cop because I wanted to help people, not hurt them like Evers did you." They drove on. Neither of them had spoken, and Decker began to wonder why. He figured he would keep going until something he said drew a response. They might be working up the nerve to do what they needed to do to him, but then again, the pair had killed so many people that he doubted they needed much preparation to put a bullet in him. "I met Clyde Evers. He told me all about what happened at the high school in Utah. So now I know why you did what you did at Mansfield. But maybe you have something you want to add." He looked at her expectantly. The eyes flashed once more, but they weren't looking at him. They were looking at Leopold. In his peripheral, Decker saw the gun muzzle bob up and down ever so slightly. When you nod your head, your hand sometimes moved in the same direction. So Leopold was calling the shots. That was telling, and maybe helpful for what Decker had come here to do. Because these two weren't the only ones on a mission. So was Amos Decker. He hadn't come here to simply die, although that was a very real possibility. Wyatt said,
"I think it speaks for itself, don't you?"
Her voice was deeper than when she was a woman, and deeper than when she had spoken to him in the role of Billy, the mop boy. It was amazing how she was able to modulate it, but the tone was far less important than the words. She didn't care. There was no remorse. There was nothing behind the eyes. She was 36 now, and he doubted she had had an easy, normal day in the last 30 of them. That couldn't help but change you. How could you respect or appreciate or care about a world and the people in that world when they loathe the fact that you shared their planet? "Did you kill the people who raped you? I mean, other than Giles Evers."
"Well, that would have been a little obvious, so I chose symbolism over literalness."
Decker felt his face flushed at these cruel words. His wife and daughter had been reduced to symbols of a warped mind seeking revenge. Decker felt Leopold's breath on his cheek. He could smell garlic and stomach bile, but no alcohol. That was good. He didn't want a drunk holding a gun against his head. But the guy took drugs, too. And you couldn't smell drugs on someone's breath. He couldn't see the tattoo of the twin dolphins because Leopold's sleeve covered it. But the tat was there, he knew that. It was real. It had all been in Leopold's file, all of it. Decker had memorized every word of that file. The crime against his family. Every detail. And the file on Evers and Mr. and Mrs. Wyatt. And the payoff from Evers. And the money that was there now. And the Justice Denied website. It had been interesting stuff. All very interesting. "I guess I can see you taking that position. I mean, the victims at Mansfield were innocent. But to you, who is innocent, really, right? Nobody."
"I know you don't feel pity, or sympathy, or empathy anymore,"
said Wyatt.
"Because I don't either. So don't even bother. I'm not stupid. I'm just like you.
The hell you are, Decker thought. He said, We found your mom and dad. They'll get a proper burial now. Not sure how you feel about that, but you made your point with them. Emmy said they'd been there a long time, so they'll be buried. The muzzle pressed harder against Decker's skin. Decker continued, My daughter never lived to your age when you were raped. About 6 years shy.
6 years, 1 month, and 18 days. She died before her 10th birthday. Or more accurately, I killed her. 3 days before her 10th birthday.
Decker felt his anger edge up, which was the last thing he needed. Actually, 3 days, 4 hours, and 11 minutes, he corrected. He locked gazes with Wyatt in the mirror. Without taking his eyes off her, he said, Are you a hyper too, Sebastian?
No, he's not. Just you and me are the freaks.
You're not a freak. Neither am I.
Oh, excuse me. I wasn't aware that you had ovaries. My mistake.
You know what I mean.
Dear Mom and Dad saw my rape as a way to get rich. You know what my father told me?
What? Asked Decker. He had not expected this outpouring from Wyatt, especially not after her first terse words. But now he realized that she needed to talk. She needed to say things, get things out, before she killed him. It was all part of a process, her process, and mine, too.
He said it was high time that I brought something positive into their lives, as though my rape was something positive in their lives. That's what he meant. And they took Clyde Evers's money and built themselves this castle in the sky. And they never let me step inside it. That was my home, you know. I bought it, not them.
I can see that.
They never even told me they had moved. They sent me away to a mental rehab facility. When I came home a week later, they were gone. I was on my own. They just abandoned me.
They were cruel, ignorant, and wrong, Belinda. She looked away from the mirror.
Who cares? Now they're just dead.
I died too. Not once, but twice. He saw the eyes flash at him in the mirror once more. On the football field, after the hit, they brought me back twice. Maybe they shouldn't have bothered. Then I wouldn't have said what I did to you, and all of those people would still be alive. One life to save all those others. Sounds like a good deal to me.
Maybe it would have been, but you didn't die. Just like I didn't die. I climbed out of that dumpster. Maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe I should have just died.
Her voice trailed off with this last part, and Decker wasn't sure, but he wondered if that constituted remorse, or at least as close as Wyatt would ever get to it now. I see my family's murders in blue, said Decker, drawing another stare from Wyatt. I know you don't suffer from synesthesia. It's odd seeing things in color that should have none. It's one of the things that scared the crap out of me when I woke up in the hospital and found out I was a different person.
Well, I was two people to begin with.
Wyatt shot back.
And after they raped and beat me nearly to death, I became someone else entirely. So that makes three. A little crowded in someone my size.
There was not a trace of mirth in her tone. She was being deadly serious. Decker would have expected nothing less. You chose male over female? Why?
Men are predators. Women are their prey. I chose never to be the prey again. I chose to be the predator. For that, I needed a full set of balls and a tank full of testosterone. Now I've got them, and all is right with my world.
Decker had figured that Leopold was calling the shots, but maybe he was wrong. If so, things are not going to work out so well for him. Where are we going? Somewhere. This was Leopold. Decker had wondered when the man was going to assert himself. Maybe he wanted Decker to know that Wyatt was not running this. Good, Sebastian, keep it up. I need you in my corner, until I don't. Somewhere is good, better than nowhere. Why are you here? Asked Leopold. Why did you come? Figured I'd save everyone the trouble. I knew you were targeting anyone associated with me. I didn't want anyone else to have to die because of me. I was surprised that you gave us a warning with the Lancaster family. He glanced at the mirror to find Wyatt watching him again. You sure you have no empathy? Asked Decker. You could have killed them.
They weren't worth the trouble.
Sandy has Down syndrome. But you knew that. Did you draw the line at killing kids like that? Wyatt focused back on the road. Leopold said, So, you come so readily to the end of your life. The gent was downright talkative now, and his formal and somewhat clunky speech was another indicator that English was not his first language. We all have to die someday. And today is your day, said Leopold. Chapter 63. They drove for 2 more hours. Decker had no idea where he was, and it really didn't matter to him. Help was not coming. The van finally pulled off the road, and Decker was bumped up and down as the vehicle hit a rough patch, but then kept going. The van hung a sharp left, and a few moments later skidded to a stop. Wyatt got out, and Leopold motioned for Decker to do the same. His bare feet hit cold gravel, and he winced as a sharp rock cut the bottom of his right foot. There was an old outdoor light in a rusted metal cage over the door they were heading to. Decker could make out the faded, peeling remnants of a sign that had been painted in red on the white brick wall. Ace Plumbing, established 1947. It looked like flakes of blood resting on the pale skin of a corpse. He looked to the right and left and saw nothing but trees. A leaning chain-link fence enclosed the abandoned property. Leopold gave him a shove in the back, and he staggered into the building behind Wyatt. Leopold closed and bolted the door after them. Wyatt was dressed in jeans and a hooded windbreaker. With the wig gone, the hair was short, blonde, and receding. As Billy, Wyatt had been wearing another wig that had drastically changed his appearance. The same with the waitress gig. Decker figured Wyatt might go bald in a few more years. If he had a few more years left to live. If any of them did. A light dimly illuminated the space. It was all concrete, mostly bare. The floor and walls splotched with grease and other dirt. An old leaning metal shelf at the far end held a couple of joint pipes. A wooden desk with a chair in the knee hole was set near the doorway to another room. A file cabinet sat behind the desk. Some wooden crates were stacked against one wall. The windows were barred and blacked out. Wyatt pulled out the chair and rolled it across the room. It bumped crazily over the chipped concrete floor. Leopold motioned with the gun for Decker to sit. He did. Wyatt took duct tape and wound it around both Decker and the chair until the two were as one. Then Wyatt pulled a large box out from behind the desk, carried it over, and turned it upside down. Tumbling out of it and clattering to the floor were all of the trophies taken from Mansfield, all the ones with Amos Decker's name on them. Wyatt picked one up and looked at it.
Football players and cops, my favorite people.
He dropped the trophy. The pair pulled up two of the old crates and sat on them, staring at Decker. Decker stared back, taking them both in, detail by detail. He could tell that Wyatt was doing the same to him. Wyatt looked nothing like the teenage girl Decker had seen back at the Institute. The 20-year march of time had hollowed out her features, giving her a perpetually hungry, emaciated look. The mouth was jagged and cruel. There were no smile lines around the edges of the lips. What did Wyatt have to smile about, ever? The long brow had worry lines that already had been forming back at the Institute. Decker glanced at Leopold. He had cleaned up some since their last meeting at the bar. His hair was combed, and his clothes looked clean. "Can you answer a couple of questions that have been bugging me?" Decker asked. When neither of them responded, he said, The old man and old woman that were seen out and about in my neighborhood and then Lancaster's neighborhood. Was that you?
Wyatt stood, pulled her hood over her head, bent over, mimicked gripping a cane, and walked slowly across the room. In a pitch-perfect impersonation of an elderly man's voice, Wyatt said,
"Can you help me find my little dog, Jasper? He's all I have left."
She pulled her hood back down and straightened.
"I can fool anyone,"
said Wyatt, staring dead at him.
"Become anyone I want."
"Yes, you can," said Decker. He wondered if Wyatt had always been able to transform like that, stuck between two genders, a foot in each, with an identity in neither, entrenched in limbo. When she had played the role of Billy, it had been a remarkable transformation, happy-go-lucky, superficial, innocuous. As she had said, she could play any role. Well, except for one. Herself. He imagined Wyatt walking through the halls of Mansfield in the getup that made him look taller and far broader. This slip of a man, formerly a woman, transformed into a giant with guns, massacring people like they were bugs in the grass. Man as predator. Man that could never be hurt by another man, like a woman could. "Why did you stay in the freezer overnight? Why not just come in through the Bayside and meet Debbie in the shop class?"
"Because Debbie was with me in the freezer that night. She snuck out of our house. We did it right then and there, the first time."
He grinned, though it didn't reach the eyes.
"She thought it was so amazing. Sex in the freezer. In the dark. It brought back memories for me, you see. I was gang-raped in the school cafeteria, but now I was the guy doing the girl. Then she left. And in the morning I used the passageway to get to the other end of the school."
"And how much did she know about the plan?" said Decker. "We found the picture of you in camis."
"I wore them sometimes when we were together. I told her I was former military, and now I was in military intelligence. She thought that was so cool. I told her I was here investigating a possible terrorist cell, and that she could help me. And of course I ended up seducing her. It wasn't hard. She knew nothing of the real plan. She just thought we were going to do it in the shop classroom, smack in the middle of everybody. I suggested it, of course. It had to happen that way."
"And how did you find out that she might know something about the passageway?"
"I read an article years ago about bomb-proof shelters being put under schools. I figured with an army base right next door, there might be such a thing, and possibly more. So I searched the old army base. It was easy to get inside. In a drawer in one of the rooms, I found a duty roster with employee names on it. Simon Watson was on there. It said he was in engineering. Sebastian and I did some more digging and found out that the old man had lived with the Watsons, and that Debbie went to Mansfield. I ran into Debbie one day. It took time, and I let my undercover story out slowly. But it finally got around to her great-grandfather and things he had told her about the base. She knew about a passage, and generally how it ran. She also knew that it connected to the base. She just didn't know exactly where. But that gave us what we needed. We started from the base end and worked our way toward the school. It all came together. And since she believed I was here on a secret mission, she understood why no one could know about us. She kept the secret. She was actually very useful."
"She called you Jesus, you know. You were the only positive in her life. She loved you very much, apparently. Right up to the second you blew her head off, Jesus." Wyatt said nothing to this. Decker glanced at Leopold. "Did you build the outfit that he wore in the school?"
"We did it together. We do everything together."
"And you found out the players on the football team and what classes they were in?"
"Debbie again. I told her I might have to recruit some of them in case I needed local muscle. It was stupid, but she'd believe anything."
"And justice denied? You left that paper at Evers' dump in Utah, so I guess you wanted us to know about it. It was how I was able to contact you.
I'm not alone,
said Wyatt. Decker glanced at her. Not alone?
There are lots of others like me. People like me can get justice, too.
Decker nodded. What name do you go by now? Or do you want me to just call you Wyatt?
You can call me Belinda. You're from that time, not from this time. Not much longer, anyway.
Okay, Belinda. And Leopold here introduced you to Justice Denied? Wyatt now looked surprised.
How could you know that?
Well, for starters, it's a foreign-based site, and Leopold is Austrian. His family was murdered. He actually started the site. Some of the word choices on there show that English was not the creator's first language. Wyatt and Leopold exchanged a glance. Decker shifted a bit in his seat. You know, it would have been easier for you to just kill me, he said, and leave my family alone.
No one left me alone,
said Wyatt.
No one.
He drew a knife from his pocket and held it up.
I used this to kill Giles Evers. His father should be getting a package in the mail any day.
He disappeared a long time ago. What have you been doing with him all this time?
Things,
said Wyatt.
Just things.
He looked like he wanted to smile, but he didn't seem that he could manage it. I don't think Clyde liked his son all that much. Giles sort of ruined his life. Wyatt stood, walked across the room, and jammed the knife into Decker's thigh. Decker screamed. When Wyatt worked the blade around, he cried out more, cursing and twisting in the chair, trying to free himself. Wyatt finally withdrew it, and Decker slumped over and threw up from the shock of it.
I didn't hit the femoral,
Wyatt said calmly, retaking a seat on the crate.
I know where it is. Trust me. I read lots of medical books. And books on embalming.
Wyatt added. He tapped his temple.
And as you know, we never forget anything.
Leopold said, And you don't get off that easy. He duct-taped the wound, though blood continued to bubble along the edges. Ashen-faced, Decker lifted his head. Wyatt was staring at him.
So you think his fucking life was ruined? Is that what you think?
Not as much as yours. No, gasped Decker, spitting vomit out of his mouth. Things were starting to accelerate now. He could afford no more mistakes. He eyed Leopold.
How many people like Belinda have you helped find justice? Not enough.
Decker used his mind to compartmentalize, to will the effects of the pain away for just a few minutes. He needed clarity of thought. He needed to be able to say what he needed to say. Otherwise, it was over.
It was good that you were in jail when the murders happened, to my family and at the high school. The judge let you go because you had an ironclad alibi.
Leopold said,
My friend here wanted to do the honors. It was only right.
So contrary to what you said, you don't do everything together. Not when it comes to the actual crimes. We have evidence against Belinda. Physical evidence. But nothing against you.
You have nothing against me,
said Wyatt sharply.
Your parents were murdered. The doctor who attended you at the Institute was murdered. I understand why you killed him. He took advantage of you. Another supposed protector who hurt you. And you left your handwriting at multiple places. And we got your print off the mop bucket at the 7-Eleven. And another from the bathroom at the bar where you were working as a waitress.
Most of this was a lie, but it didn't matter. He looked at Leopold. But nothing on this guy. But like he said, you wanted to do the honors, while he stayed safely in the background. Leopold stood and gazed at Wyatt.
I think it's time to end this.
Decker quickly said, Clyde Evers paid your parents $6 million to keep quiet about what his son did to you. The house in Colorado cost $1.8 million. They didn't make any improvements to it. We checked their financial records. Their expense burn rate was only about 20% of the amounts thrown off by their investment portfolio. The rest just accumulated over time. Stocks did well. By the time you killed them, they had over $10 million in liquid assets. But someone got his hands on the authorization codes to start taking money out. About $1 million a month, and counting, over the last 9 months. It's almost all gone now. Did you take it, Belinda?
That was bribe money to keep my parents quiet, and they told me if I said anything, they would make sure the whole world knew I was a freak. They'd taken pictures of me down there. They said they would send it to the newspapers, so no. I didn't take the money. I didn't want that. That blood money. My blood.
So I wonder where the cash went. Maybe your buddy here knows. Wyatt's gaze darted to Leopold and then back at Decker.
I don't understand anything you're talking about,
Wyatt said mechanically. Leopold has apparently helped a lot of folks with justice denied, and the folks he helps have two things happen to them. First, whatever money is around disappears. Second, the friend he's helping ends up dead. Decker had no idea if this was true, but he suspected that it was. The outflow of cash from the Wyatts' account had to have gone somewhere, and he doubted that Leopold would want the heir around to find out. When he looked at Leopold, the expression on the man's face told him that he was right. Decker said, "And did he tell you that his family was murdered, wife and daughter?"
"They were murdered,"
said Wyatt. "Yes, they were."
"By cops?"
"No, not by cops. He killed them." Decker heard the hammer of the gun being pulled back.
"You're full of shit. You're lying,"
screamed Wyatt. "Anger, lack of control. That's good. To a point." Decker slowly shook his head. "I read the file. I looked at the pictures of the corpses. They were both strangled to death by hanging. At the napes of their necks, where the ligatures compressed the life out of them, they found a very unusual mark. It was nearly identical on both. The Austrian police didn't know what it was. They were baffled because the killer had cut the victims down and taken the rope with him. They were baffled because they never suspected Leopold. Lucky guy had another ironclad alibi provided by a couple of buddies who swore he was in Germany at the time. If they had suspected Leopold and done some digging, they probably would have arrived at the truth behind the mark." Decker felt the gun muzzle against his head. Leopold said, "You said you died twice. Well, they say the third time is the charm." Decker kept going. "I had seen that mark before. It was in a book I read, and of course never forgot. Because we can never forget anything, can we, Belinda? Like you said." He paused and studied her. When she seemed about to speak, he said sharply, "It's called a double constrictor knot. It's like a clove hitch, but with an overhand knot under two riding turns. I actually practiced tying it on the flight back from Utah. I discovered that it's nearly impossible to untie once the knot is set. In fact, it's one of the most effective binding knots in the world. Been around at least since the 1860s. It's also called the gunner's knot." He glanced at Leopold. "Every sailor worth his salt knows how to tie that knot. And before your friend here was on submarines, he grew up sailing with his father, who was a fisherman working in the Adriatic Sea 6 months out of the year." He looked at Wyatt. "I can keep going. As you know, it's all in my head. Every fact, every detail."
"Submarines?" said Leopold contemptuously. "Austria doesn't have a navy."
"No, but Russia does, which is where you went to live when you were 19. You were kicked out of the Russian navy for stealing from your fellow sailors. It took me the longest time to pin down your accent, because it's a blend, Austrian-Russian with an overlay of English." He glanced sideways at Leopold. "Ist good, Herr Leopold. You said it at the bar, and you said it again just a minute ago. Maybe you didn't even realize." Leopold struck him on the side of the head with the gun. Decker slumped over.
Now his leg and his head were hurting like a bitch. His tolerance for pain was greater than most. He didn't play football for as long as he had without being able to take pain. But a bullet to the head would not be painful. He would just be dead.
He looked up at Wyatt, who was looking at Leopold. Decker couldn't see Leopold's face, so he didn't know where he was looking. But the gun was now pressed against his temple. You see the lump on his neck, Belinda? I think the guy is terminal and doesn't give a shit what he does. He's also a druggie and needs money for that. And I think he likes to make other people do things. I think he's a con man who likes to take people who are in desperate circumstances and screw with them. And if he makes millions in the process, like he did with you, so much the better.
Sebastian?
Said Wyatt weakly. That was not what Decker wanted to hear. That was not going to cut it.
He's full of shit, said Leopold.
That was also not going to cut it. Decker barked, You killed all those people, Belinda. But there were gaps. Nearly 20 years go by, and then you kidnap Giles Evers. Then you come and kill my family. Who was next? Your parents? Chris Sizemore? Then a gap. Then Mansfield. And then Nora Lafferty.
And now you, snarled Leopold.
Why the gaps, Belinda? Why come after me 20 years later? Was it him? Was it this guy? Justice denied? Is that why all that time went by before you started killing? From the moment I said it 20 years ago, I know you remembered that I wanted to be a cop. I recall the stunned look on your face, the hurt you were feeling, but you did nothing with it. Not all that time. Until you ran into this guy, and you told him. And you told him about your parents' blackmail money, and he saw his chance. And in your mind, he twisted what I said and made it into your absolute obsession, your total and complete vendetta. The one thing that you could do to make it all right. The only thing in life you cared about, because otherwise you would have no life.
Why would I do that? Said Leopold. This was her revenge, not mine. She had to make it right. She came to me.
So it was her idea to make herself look like a big man with guns blazing, mowing down defenseless kids. He looked at Wyatt. Are you telling me that's what you wanted, Belinda? Seducing a vulnerable young woman like Debbie Watson and then blowing her head off? You came up with that? She was almost your age when you were raped. She was just a scared kid with a screwed-up home life, like you had. She wanted to have a better life, and you seduced her, made her fall in love with you to such an extent that she called you Jesus, her savior. And then you just killed her? Like she was nothing? Like she didn't matter? Like you didn't matter? Like when people who you thought would protect you did just the opposite? Is that your idea of revenge, Belinda? Because I'm not buying it. That's not you. I don't care how much you changed, you haven't changed that much. Wyatt said nothing, but Decker took it as a positive sign that Wyatt was not looking at him. She was staring at Leopold. She rose from the crate.
Did you take my parents' money?
Why would I? Do you see me rolling in cash?
Decker was not going to lose control of the situation. He barked out, He does it for kicks, Belinda. He likes to manipulate. He must have loved what you did at the school. It was choreographed like a play. And maybe he has the money socked away in a bank somewhere. But he killed his family. So why would he have founded Justice Denied? The only justice denied with Leopold was his getting away with murdering his family. Wyatt said,
Is this true?
Decker expected more denials. He did not get them.
Yes, said Leopold emphatically. Do you feel better?
He swiveled the gun away from Decker's head. At the same moment, Decker launched himself sideways, pushing off mostly with his good leg and taking the chair with him. The gun fired. Chapter 64. Decker catapulted headlong into Leopold, finally delivering the hit on the field during the kickoff denied to him for 2 decades. It felt good. Leopold fell sideways with a brutal impact. Decker was sure the man had never been hit that hard in his life. Those who only watched pro football from the safety of their stadium seats or big-screen TVs could never imagine the devastating power of enormous men running at speed into other enormous men. It was like being in a car accident over and over. It didn't merely hurt, it stunned. It shocked the body in so many different ways that one could never be the same afterward. It pushed bone, muscle, ligaments, and brains to places they were never intended to go.
It was no wonder that so many men who had played the game were now suffering the long-term debilitating effects of entertaining millions and making large sums of money for doing so.
Decker landed directly on top of Leopold, his full weight coming to rest on the much smaller man who was half his weight. A few seconds later, Decker smelled the stench. He had hit Leopold so hard that the man's bowels had involuntarily released. Leopold kicked at him. Then he tried to raise the gun to fire at him. But Decker, just as he had with Bogart, brought his weight down on top of the man and felt all the air leave him.
His wide, heavy shoulder jammed down on Leopold's right arm, forcing it to remain straight out.
Leopold was trying with all his might to turn the gun back toward Decker so that he could fire, but the angle was impossible. With the barrel pointed that way, his finger couldn't reach the trigger. The weapon was useless.
Which meant that it was man versus man here, and with the difference in size, there would only be one possible outcome.
Leopold seemed to understand this because he smashed his knee against Decker's wound. Decker screamed in agony. But he closed his eyes and gritted his teeth, and little by little managed to straighten his legs out from the sitting position he had been forced into by the chair and duct tape. He felt the tape lengthening, though it did not break. But inch by inch, Decker pushed and stretched and pushed some more, until he was finally flattened out and his 350-plus pounds were lying directly on the much smaller man. Leopold's breathing was ragged now. His body lurched up, trying to throw Decker off, but it was like an elephant on his chest. And then Decker started to do something he never would have with Bogart, because he had never intended to end the life of the FBI agent. He very much intended to end the life of this man. Without the duct tape holding him back, he would already have killed Leopold. But he still would. He just needed to be patient. So he began to inch his right shoulder in a new direction, a small measure at a time, while his other shoulder and upper arm remained jammed down on the limb holding the gun, keeping his opponent, in effect, weaponless. The Smith & Wesson was not going to kill again. Leopold kept kicking and pushing and bucking, but the space for him to operate was now severely limited and growing ever smaller. Decker kept his eyes closed, but the tears were running down his face with the pain. The bile rose to his throat, and he threw up on Leopold. The smaller man gagged and spit and cursed and heaved. He knew time was running out, and he was not going to go quietly. Decker was in terrible pain. The wound was bleeding freely again. He felt his strength start to be sapped by the blood loss. But he didn't really need strength. He just needed his bulk concentrated on one spot in particular, so he kept working at it, and his shoulder finally fell into the crevice that he had been striving so mightily for, under Leopold's chin, and directly against the man's throat. And then Decker let his weight bear down directly on this spot. His bare feet touched the concrete, gaining traction and leverage, and he thrust his pelvis forward, and with it his huge shoulder, ramming it against the man's windpipe and compressing Leopold's chest so his lungs could not inflate. His big belly was sucking in and out through the opening of the jumpsuit with the effort of it all. Sweat dripped off him, though the room was cold. He was not going to stop until it was done. His heart was hammering out of control. He felt dizzy and sick. His head felt ready to burst, but he didn't think about any of that. His one focused thought was to kill this man. Decker let his bulk collapse, making himself as much dead weight as possible. He wished he weighed a ton. He kept driving and driving like he was slamming into a blocking sled over and over. He never had the talent of others on the gridiron, but his motor had never stopped. And no one, from the superstars down to the journeymen, ever worked harder than he did. So this was his moment. This was his one play to end all plays. He heard gasping, which wasn't enough. He kept compressing. He was a gunner's knot. He was the constrictor. He was never going to stop until this was over. Never. He heard gurgling, which still wasn't enough. He pushed down harder. He was a whale on a minnow. It had never felt so damn good to be obese. He wanted to swallow this piece of shithole. He wanted to make him disappear from the earth. He heard a long, low exhalation, which would never be enough. He rammed his body down with all his strength. In his mind, his DVR whirled. Every victim, every face, raced through his mind while he was slowly killing their killer. Then his DVR slowed, and two faces held steady. Cassie and Molly. That was all he could see in that enormous cavern his mind had become. It was the whole damn universe in there. It could hold so much and was ever expanding. Yet still, right now, it held only their two faces. That was all. And it seemed more than fitting. More than right. He smashed down one more time as he mumbled, "I love you, Cassie. I love you, Molly. I love you both so much." Then he heard nothing. Nothing at all. The lungs had not inflated, because they no longer could. And Leopold's body finally went limp, and the gun fell to the concrete. That was enough. He lifted his head and stared down at the man. There were few things in life that were certain. There were many things in death that were. He was staring at three of them, eyes wide open, pupils fixed, mouth involuntarily sagging. Dead. In Decker's mind, the images of his wife and daughter slowly faded like a movie ending. "And I miss you both so much. I will miss you forever." He rolled off Leopold and then lay there panting for a few minutes. He had never felt so tired in all his life. His gut was clenching, his legs and head were throbbing. He could feel the swelling on his face from where Leopold had struck him with the gun. And with his heart racing, blood was now starting to flow more rapidly from his wounded leg. But most of him, the most important parts of him anyway, felt good. Felt terrific, in fact. It took him the better part of 5 minutes, but he finally managed to stand with the chair and the saggy, stretched-out duct tape still wrapped around him. He threw himself against the wall repeatedly until the chair fell away in pieces. Then he tugged and ripped until he was free of the tape and stepped out of his prison. He turned to look across the room. He hadn't seen it before, during his struggles with Leopold, but still, he had known. She hadn't joined the fight after all, either on his side or Leopold's. There had to be a reason for that. Now he was looking at that reason. He had been wrong. The Smith and Wesson had killed again, or it was about to. He staggered over to where Wyatt lay on the floor, blood still flowing out of her chest from where the shot had struck her. He knelt down next to her. She looked far more male than female, but to him she would always be a woman. A 16-year-old girl, in fact, who'd suffered so much, too much, more than anyone should. Dr. Marshall had said that these days someone with Belinda's intersex condition was always involved in the decision as to what gender to become fully and finally. But someone should never feel compelled to choose to be a man simply because she was terrified of being a woman. She was not dead yet, but she soon would be. The pool of blood around her seemed to exceed what was left inside her. He had no way to staunch the bleeding. And in truth, Decker also didn't have the desire. He looked first at her hands, the hands that had strangled the life out of his daughter, then at the finger that had pulled the trigger on the gun that had killed his wife, the hands that had slit throats and fired shotguns and wrapped a mother and father in plastic and stabbed an FBI agent in the heart. Then he gazed down at the face. The eyes were starting to fix, the breathing to relax. The body's transition to death was commencing in earnest. The brain was telling the rest of the body that it was over and that everything would soon shut down. It was doing all this in as orderly a fashion as possible, given that the cause was a hole in the chest driven there by violent means. Decker had died before, too. He didn't remember white lights, or a tunnel to brightness, or angels singing. For a man who could never forget anything, he could remember nothing of dying. He had no idea if that was comforting or not. He just wanted to be alive. He sat down on his haunches next to her. Part of him wanted to take Leopold's gun and blow her brains out. Part of him wanted to use his huge hands to crush the remaining life out of her, to hurry her on to where she was inevitably going anyway. But he didn't. Only once did her eyes flicker and seem to fix on his. There was a look there, just a glimpse, perhaps imagined. Decker didn't know when he thought he was looking at the scared 16-year-old girl back at the Institute. He sighed and closed his eyes for a moment, but didn't even try to process what had become an unimaginable tragedy all around. So he simply sat there and watched her die. And when she did, he closed her eyes. But he could close nothing that had come before, and Decker knew he never would. And whether he wanted it or not, Amos Decker, Sebastian Leopold, and Belinda Wyatt, in life and now in death, were all bound together. Forever. But he was immeasurably relieved to be the one left standing. Chapter 65. A bench. Christmas Eve. A light snow was falling. It collected on top of the foot that had already fallen over the last 3 days. The stores were closed. The shopping was done. And after the cataclysmic events at Mansfield, everyone in Burlington was getting ready to sleep and then awake to a day of peace and quiet spent with family. Well, almost everyone. Amos Decker sat on the bench staring across at Mansfield High, but really he was staring at nothing. In deference to the weather, he had on a new overcoat and a wool-lined flapped hat. His hands were gloved, and he wore brand-new size 14 heavy-duty waterproof boots. His thigh was nearly healed, though it would always carry a scar where the knife had struck, and Belinda Wyatt had both symbolically and literally twisted the blade in him. Decker had gotten in the van and driven to a shopping mall about 30 miles away, using the GPS on Leopold's phone to direct him. He had called Bogart and given his location to the FBI agent. Bogart had ordered up a local medevac chopper, which had arrived surprisingly fast. They'd triaged him on the spot and then flown him to the nearest hospital. Before driving off in the van, he'd done a tourniquet on his leg, but he'd still lost over 2 pints of blood by the time help arrived. He had given Bogart the location of Leopold and Wyatt's hideout. The crime scene had been processed. But, by far, the two most important pieces of forensic evidence were the two bodies that lay barely 6 feet apart. One shot by a .45 with a murderous trail attached to it. The other, literally, suffocated to death by a fat guy. Both deserve what they got, and only one of the people they'd killed had really deserved to die. They had never found Giles Evers's body, but as Belinda Wyatt had promised, a package had arrived at his father's house. Clyde Evers reportedly had dropped dead when he opened it. Getting a severed head in the mail will do that. Decker corrected himself. So maybe two people who deserved to die had. and maybe four if you included Belinda's parents, who, out of naked greed, had turned against their fragile daughter when she needed them most. He did not want to think about death on Christmas Eve, but he seemed so surrounded by it that it tended to crowd out all other things. He had visited the graves of his wife and daughter. Lancaster had surprised him by showing up, too, and laying flowers on their graves. They had talked quietly for a few minutes, snatching some normalcy from what was undeniably abnormal. Decker was sitting here because the Residence Inn had thrown a Christmas party for the guests staying there over the holidays. He had no impulse whatsoever to participate in that. Hence, he had opted for a bench in the snow over unspiked eggnog and people seeking him out for lively but mindless conversation, which he could neither process nor appreciate. The decision had been made to reopen Mansfield the following school year. All the blood would be scrubbed away by then, but all other stains would remain there forever. The governor was planning to come and give a speech on the occasion of the school's reopening. Decker did not plan to attend the ceremony. The town had bricked over the entrance to the underground walkway leading from the cafeteria to the shop class, and the army was officially cementing shut the connecting tunnel. Bulldozers were scheduled to arrive on January 2nd to level the entire abandoned base and haul away the remnants to wherever old military bases went to die. The national press had descended on the place when the news had broken about the identity of the killers and their deaths. Bogart had managed to keep Decker's name out of everything. The FBI agent had turned out to be a good man who actually cared about things worth caring about. Most folks would have wanted to be recognized as the one who stopped two killers in their tracks, risking his life to do so. These days, money would have flowed from that. Books and movie deals, endorsements, offers to join high-level investigative firms, opportunities to be wined and dined by the movers and shakers. Decker could have had millions of followers online riveted on his every tweet or Instagram posting. Again, he would have opted for a bullet to the head over all that. Yet, he had allowed Bogart to buy him clothes and shoes to replace the ones he'd lost to Leopold and Wyatt. For a poor man, any loss is a heavy one. Bogart had pleaded with Decker to accept payment from the federal government for his work. Captain Miller had done the same on behalf of the Burlington Police Department. "You were a hired consultant, Amos," he had said over and over, until he just didn't have the strength to say it again. Decker had refused it all. He had not done so for noble reasons. He needed money to live. He wasn't shy about taking what was due him. He had refused it out of guilt. "I stood up in front of Belinda Wyatt and said I wanted to be a cop. I said I wanted to be a cop because cops protect people. She never forgot that, and twisted something innocuous into something sinister. And when Leopold came along to add fuel to that fire, building it into an inferno, the result was I unwittingly caused the deaths of so many people, including the two I can't really live without." It didn't matter to him that it was done unwittingly. It clearly didn't matter to the dead that he hadn't intended it. But with anything, there was cause and effect. And I was the cause. And the effect was too terrible to even think about, though it seemed he could think of nothing else. Decker could not afford to wallow in self-pity, contemplating this while gazing at his navel. He had to earn a living, and so at some point soon he would push off this bench and go in search of gainful employment. But now, right now, this evening, before Santa Claus came calling, he was just going to sit here and wallow in self-pity and at least pretend to gaze at his substantial navel. But then again, maybe not. The man sat down next to him and crossed his legs, shivering slightly from the cold. Decker didn't look at him. "I thought you'd be back in D.C. by now." Bogart shrugged. "I was, but I had some unfinished business here." "It's Christmas Eve. Won't your family miss you?" "What family?" You have a ring on your finger.
I'm separated, Decker. Recent event.
Sorry to hear that.
She's not, and in all honesty, neither am I.
Kids?
She's a Hill staffer and works ungodly hours, so neither one of us ever found the time at the same time.
Wyatt told you she had sex with Debbie Watson?
She was lying about that, replied Decker.
How did you know?
Because you're right. Autopsy revealed she hadn't transitioned entirely to a man. The equipment wasn't all there. The whole time she sat with her knees together, tough for a guy to do. But more than that, I don't think she really wanted to be a man. What happened to her made that decision for Wyatt, but she couldn't go the whole way.
Both fell silent.
Okay. Cutting to the chase. I'd like you to come work with me.
Decker turned to look at him.
What does that mean, exactly?
That means exactly. At the FBI.
Decker shook his head.
I couldn't pass the physical. I couldn't pass anything.
You wouldn't be a special agent, of course, but I've been assigned to put together and head up a special task force made up of professionals from a wide range of occupations and disciplines, and that includes civilians. The goal is to catch really bad guys, and I can't think of anyone better suited to that than you.
But I'm not a professional anything.
You were a cop and then a detective. You have the experience and God knows you have the brains.
You don't have to do this, Bogart. You bought me the boots and clothes.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I want to move up at the Bureau. My career is all I have left now. I'm pushing 50. I've got to hit the turbo soon, or else I'm just wasting my time. And I figure with you on my side, my odds of cracking the really tough cases go way up. And then promotions will follow. I wouldn't mind one day running the place.
So you mean leave Burlington?
Bogart stared straight ahead.
Would that be a problem for you?
I didn't say that.
So it wouldn't be a problem for you?
I didn't say that either.
Bogart looked at him.
Can I cut to the chase and up the ante?
Decker said nothing but gave a small nod. Bogart held up his cell phone and flashed a light. A minute later, Decker could hear footsteps coming. Alex Jameson came into the ring of light thrown by the street lamp. She had on a long winter overcoat and calf boots, and a scarf was wrapped around her head. She stopped in front of the bench and looked down. Decker looked at her and then at Bogart.
What am I missing? He said.
I thought it would be obvious, said Bogart, for a smart guy like you.
Decker looked back at Jameson.
He made me the same offer, Decker, although I think it had a lot more to do with you than me.
Bogart said, she made some good finds in the investigation, showed some guts and intuition. I know she's a journalist by trade, but I'm just looking for talent. Wherever I can find it.
You'd leave Burlington? Decker asked her.
To tell the truth, I already have.
What about being a reporter?
Andy Jackson taught me to find the truth. I figure that holds true for your line of work, too. And maybe I can do more good working with Bogart than I can seeing my byline on a story.
Decker glanced at Bogart. Does Captain Miller know you're making me this offer?
Yes. He's not thrilled about it, but he understands. And Lancaster is being promoted to his second in command. And in case you didn't know, she's taking meds for the tremor in her hand and it's working. And she's put on some weight now that she's stopped smoking.
Decker nodded to all this, but didn't break his silence.
Bogart said, so you'll think about it?
No.
Decker,
began Jameson in protest.
I won't think about it because I'm going to do it.
Bogart and Jameson exchanged surprised glances. Decker looked at them both. But tonight, I'd prefer to be here by myself. Bogart got to his feet at the same time that Jameson said,
and we'll be back tomorrow, and you won't be by yourself ever again. I think you've been alone long enough.
They turned to walk off, but Jameson looked over her shoulder.
Merry Christmas, Amos.
He acknowledged this with a tilt of his head, and they walked on and was soon out of sight. Amos Decker closed his eyes, and with it, his mind. If only for a little while. For just a little while. This has been a Hachette audio production of Memory Man, written by David Baldacci, read by Ron McClarty and Orla Cassidy, produced and directed by Kevin Thompson, recorded by Casey Horton at Cedar Park Recording, sound edited by Chris Howerton, post-production by Merlin Music, New York City. Memory Man is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2015, Columbus Rose Limited. Audio production copyright 2015, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audio